You know, in most of my presentations, I'm normally talking to a room full of folks, and in those kind of presentations, I tend to get pretty animated and put on my Baptist preacher. The problem is that such grandiose gestures are normally lost in translating them to a computer screen. Big rooms don't open themselves to the intimacy of this more one-on-one feeling interaction. So instead of talking to all of you, let me simply talk just to you. This presentation is for you. It seeks to bolster you if you are defiant and stand bravely before the crushing weight of the status quo. It also seeks to give hope to you if you've been silenced by the chorus of the mediocre and resistant to change. It seeks to show the way forward for you and for all libraries in a time of great challenge, change, and opportunity. It is also a statement that you are not alone, you are not crazy, you are right. Librarianship is not about cataloging, or books, or buildings, or committees. It's about learning, knowledge, and making the world a better place. Now, imagine if I asked you to sketch out for me a picture or a map of librarianship. You might come up with something like this, and you can also guess where I've been staying in Chicago for the conference. Right, so we have libraries, and we break them down into technical services and public services, and maybe these down to cataloging and reference and so on. Maybe you might start by dividing the world into different library types first, but in any case, it might not look too different from this. And you would not be alone. If you look at the majority of books on librarianship in libraries, or LIS school curricula, or even the Wikipedia entry on librarians, you'll see this way of characterizing libraries by their functions, what they do. Certainly, this is loud and clear behind last year's ALA core competency document put out by ALA. It reads like a list of thou shalts, as in thou shalt no cataloging and thou shalt no technology. And that's fine, so long as you understand why thou shalt want to do anything. Have you ever asked why? Not just why so many start with functions, but why do we even do these functions? I know. This sounds like an introductory class in library school, but give me a minute. You see, there are some real problems to taking a functional view of librarianship, or any profession, really. Let me just list two. The first is false equivalencies. Look, we as a species are wired to look for patterns and familiar analogs. When we encounter something new, we try to see how it was like something old. We use the functions we already know to predict how new things are going to work and behave. That's why the first cars were called horseless carriages and why we still dial telephones, even though there hasn't been a functional rotary dial telephone produced in this country in the past 20 years that wasn't made as some sort of novelty item. Well, whole fields do this as well. Are you really a part of a conference right now? Or are you part of something new that we've wrapped schedules and speakers and sessions around? How many times have you run into folks who want your library's website to look more like Google with a single search box? Because after all, they both do search stuff, right? Or look like Amazon, because we do books too. Never mind that Google's attempt to search bibliographic data has been shown to be less than optimal with their work with Open WorldCat, or that Amazon also sells garden rakes. The second problem with functional approaches is that doing something really well doesn't necessarily tell you what you should be doing next. In fact, if you get really good at something, you have a really hard time of thinking about what should replace what it is that you're doing. Have you ever been in a conversation about how to protect the library's investment in bibliographic data? Meaning, I just spent a lot on all these MARC records, I don't want to waste that by doing something else? It certainly has been argued that the current state of the U.S. automotive companies has something to do with them being really good at building large cars and trucks, while the markets have moved to fuel efficiency and premium on design. Let me show you two examples in action, these two functions in action, and their consequences. The first example I want to look at is to compare Wikipedia with Microsoft Encarta. Now, put yourself in 2004. Both Wikipedia and Encarta are encyclopedias. One might, and did, argue that they were serving the same function. With hindsight, we can see they were trying to do this task, explaining the world's subjects, very differently. But in 2004, who would you have bet on to succeed? Microsoft, with its billions of dollars, paid experts, a huge marketing budget, and an installed base of Encarta users from their CD-ROM products? Or Wikipedia, a bunch of amateurs with a wiki? Now, let's look at what happened over time in terms of market share. In fact, as of October, Encarta ceases to exist. once again, in hindsight, we can see that the model of anyone adding content was a significantly different way of doing things, but that is more about the philosophy of encyclopedias than their functions. After all, both had articles and editors, but Wikipedia did things to allow anyone to play. That's why they use a wiki. While Encarta was based in an existing strategy, a successful strategy of encyclopedias at the time, namely, expertise counts. Britannica is now seeing that and adding wiki-like functions, but is it too late? Why did they resist for so long? One could hardly argue it was because Britannica did not succeed in the past. The bottom line is that Wikipedia and Encarta were not truly functionally equivalent. One was really a broadcast platform, while the other was a social platform. And Encarta, based on its previous success, didn't know how to respond. We could do this all day with other examples like, take a look at GeoCities versus MySpace. Supposedly, both sites are about the same function, building a personal web space. And yet, over time, we can see GeoCities stagnate while MySpace takes off. Why? Well, GeoCities is based on the premise that you are building a personal web page to broadcast out, while MySpace is about having a place on the web to hang out and invite other folks in. Similar functions, but radically different approaches. This also talks of a growing pressure for participation, but we'll come back to that. In case after case of encyclopedias or personal web spaces or search engines, like Google versus AltaVista and so on, we see that false functional equivalencies and a failure to be strategic has an effect. There are also plenty of non-digital examples, like the use of the Dewey Decimal System versus Rag and Aitken's faceted classifications. The point is, we need a way at looking at librarianship that doesn't simply collect all our current activities, bundle them together, and then try to tweak around the edges. What we really need is a much more fundamental understanding of librarianship that both honors our success of the past, but charts the way towards an even greater future. That's what the Conversance Conference, of which this is part of, and the whole participatory librarianship movement has been about, a new librarianship. Let me draw a new picture, and rather than starting with a set of functions, let's start with a purpose, a mission. The mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. I want you to note a few things about this mission statement. The first is that it is just as much about why we do something to improve society as how, through facilitating knowledge creation. The second is that it is the mission of librarians, not of libraries. Libraries are buildings and organizational charts. They can't do anything. It takes people, dedicated, skilled, smart people to make things happen. By making the mission about libraries, it both makes the acts and the responsibilities for those acts abstract. The mission of the new librarian is very personal. You have a responsibility to improve society. You are both important and accountable. What do you call a building full of books? A warehouse. What do you call an empty room with a librarian in it? A library. But this is not really a picture or a map. It's a question, rather extremely vague. What do I mean by facilitate, or knowledge for that matter, and improve society? Really? Little old me? Well, yes, but we'll get there too. What we need to do is ground the mission in the specifics of why and how and even where. Let's start by taking the major parts of the mission and mapping them. What do I mean by a mission, and where did that mission come from? Okay, lots of people are into knowledge creation and improving things. What makes librarians special or unique? Define improve, please, and give some examples. Facilitating is a pretty vague term, isn't it? How do I do this? Knowledge? I thought we were in the information business. Communities? Isn't that just for public libraries? Now, I'm not going to keep you here for the next week and a half walking you through this whole exercise, so let me hit some highlights, and we'll start with that knowledge thing. It is really the basis for this whole new approach. You see, I don't think libraries are in the information business. We're in the knowledge business. The difference? We actually care that people benefit from the information we give them. In essence, we have a service orientation and principles that care about the people who are using the information. This is very different than, say, Bing, who cares that people come back to a site so they can see advertisements. It just so happens that useful information in the product keeps people coming back. Okay, so is this a distinction without a difference? Nope. I can prove it. I give you a rock. Okay, not just any rock, but a rock outside of Taliesin West, Frank Lloyd Wright's camp in Arizona. Now, I look at it, and I see a rock. But a geologist might see a particular kind of rock. He or she could determine the type of rock, how it was formed, where it came from, even how old it is. An archaeologist might note the ideogram scratched on the surface and understand the significance of this rock to a Native American culture. My point is that knowledge of composition, type, age, or cultural significance is not in the rock. It is brought to the rock from the geologist or the archaeologist. In fact, when I see this rock, I think about my trip to Scottsdale with my wife. Well, what's true for the rock is true for books or web pages or DVDs. There is no such thing as quote-unquote recorded knowledge, because knowledge is resident in humans, not in inanimate objects. And how did that knowledge become resident in the person or group or society? Well, for that, we turn to something called conversation theory that tells us that knowledge is created through conversation. Conversation theory was developed by Gordon Pask in the 70s as he tried to teach machines to learn. He figured that he would start with how people do it. What he found was that people learn, build knowledge, by engaging in conversations. These conversations can be with librarians and teachers and friends and experts. However, most of the conversations are with themselves. The instructional librarians and school librarians among you may have noticed or may have heard of things like critical thinking or metacognition. I won't go into much detail, but it is a back and forth between two or more conversants, whether that's within the individual or outside the individual, seeking agreements. Agreements might be facts, 2 plus 2 equals 4, 4 plus 4 equals 8, it's sunny outside, or opinions. Libraries are cool, libraries are not cool, catalogs are good, or simply an agreement not to agree. The whole of these agreements determine what we know and how we react. Now, for those keeping track, you may remember me saying that people look for patterns to figure out new things by seeing how they're similar to old things. All of these agreements that I'm talking about constitute what we already know. What's important is that all of these agreements don't just sit in nice, discrete buckets in our head, but rather they are related together. Want an example? I'm going to give you a word, and I want you to think about what it means. Ready? Light. L-I-G-H-T. Think about what light means. Now, you might have thought about not heavy or illumination. But what about set ablaze? It makes sense, right? What if I showed you this picture? Now, what if I give you a term like OMG? I'm guessing you didn't think Omni Media Group or Object Management Group. I can almost guarantee you that you thought, oh my God, what's going on here? Well, you understand concepts like light and OMG, but with light, there's a huge number of combinations and relationships, so your brain just sort of picks one, kind of arbitrarily. All the others make sense, and when I show you the picture, your brain can rapidly narrow the possible meanings. Now, what's interesting is with this picture, in 10 years, if you show this to someone who's 5 years old today, they may have no idea what that is, because it's not twisty and looks like a soft serve ice cream. Now, with OMG, not only do you have very few relationships, but the one that exists is very strong. My point with all of this is that knowledge is about conversations. So if libraries are in the knowledge business, they're also in the conversation business. This also loops back to the question of why we do things and how. Why are libraries going from quiet buildings with loud rooms to loud buildings with quiet rooms? Could it be that people need to talk? Why? Oh, that's how they build knowledge. It makes sense for things like information commons and providing meeting rooms and even for providing spaces to build knowledge, not simply read. It also shows us a way forward in things like cataloging. It turns out that how items are related together is more important than the items themselves. It also turns out that how one person or group relates ideas or books or web pages together is not going to be universally understood by other people and groups. This was, and is, a real problem when you could only put a physical object in one place, but with digital information, even digital metadata about a physical object, we can allow users to co-locate and relate anything and not have this interfere with other people doing the same task. It also talks of making libraries of all types more social. I call this the pressure for participation. If knowledge is both a set of interactivities, conversations, and a very personal thing, building my set of relationships, then it pushes me as the learner to actively shape not only the conversation, but the setting of those conversations. If I'm in charge of my learning, I need to also have some say in the spaces, physical or virtual, in which I do it. So I come to Wikipedia. I don't see my topic. I can add it. I see a topic I don't agree with. I can edit it. In essence, I can shape this space to meet my learning needs. I come to Encarta, I'm out of luck. Is the rise of social networking sites like Facebook and MySpace a matter of vanity? Or is it a technology that finally allows me to shape the systems to reflect how I see the world, my friends, my walls, my applications? I would argue these sites are driven by a very selfish need to learn, not a quest to give. Why do I create? Because that's what knowledge is, an act of creation, not simply a mindless absorption. We see this happening in physical spaces with meeting rooms, coffee bars, and comfy couches. But what about online? How do people get together and have conversations through the library's website? Or more importantly, how can they have these conversations with library resources and services in their own spaces, like Facebook? Note, this is not a functional discussion of things like blogs and social networks, what they do, how to do a blog, but we have now some guidance as to why to do these things or why not to do these things. For example, in a set of focus groups, a public library asked teens what they wanted from a library website. The answer shocked the librarians. The teens wanted librarians to blog. The librarians, through further investigation, found out the teens were looking for readers' advisory service, but they didn't want some anonymous list of good books. Rather, they wanted to know the librarian, their personality, their tastes, and so on, before they knew if they could trust the recommendations. In essence, the teens needed a way to engage librarians in a conversation so they could come to an agreement about the usefulness of their reading recommendations. This is very different than saying libraries should blog, or talking about how to blog, or even presenting a bunch of examples where blogging has worked. Instead, it explains why it works and in what circumstances. If the librarians had started a blog and simply put on a list of books to be read without any personal information or critique, the teens would not have cared about blogging, and blogging would have been determined to be a failure. The lesson is why trumps how. So we can add conversation theory and these concepts to our map of librarianship. And we can do this with all the threads off of our mission. In fact, that's just what we've been doing. Here's a little thread on knowledge. Looks like what we've been talking about. And we can keep going and defining librarianship and breaking these concepts down until we create an entire map of the field of librarianship. And an amazing thing happens when you do this. You begin to get a feel for where to go. For example, music reading rooms looking much less like stacks and CDs and much more like two pianos on a stage. This came out of work with the Philadelphia Free Library. We talked with the musical community and we asked them what they want from their public library. They said, two grand pianos on a stage. When musicians talk to themselves and each other, they often use music as a language. An environment without instruments leaves them with a pretty impoverished conversation. They also validate their work through performance. If it has been performed, it is more valuable. And in downtown Philly, there simply were not enough venues. I'm talking with a brilliant librarian, Meg Backus, about having the library work with the manufacturing sector in her area to build a workspace, a workshop. Now instead of reading about carpentry or prototype development, people are going to be able to do it. The collection of the library will not be books about carpentry and information and manuals, but it will in fact be band saws and drill presses and expert craftsmen to walk you through using the equipment. And that's librarianship, because it comes down to facilitating knowledge creation and conversations. By mapping the field, we also get a sense that information discovery systems look much more like threads than catalogs. This figure was created in thinking about electronic reserve system for an academic library and what it might look like. What was, and well is, happening was that a professor would hand in his syllabus, the library would take a list of all the readings and toss out the syllabus. The thing is that the syllabus is more than just a list. It is a conversation starter, or more precisely, the representation of the professor's conversation about a given topic or class. It doesn't simply list readings, but it gives them context and sequence and relates them to student work through assignments. Imagine pulling up a syllabus and wandering through the readings into the student portfolios. Now imagine using this kind of system for the next accreditation visit, where folks want to know what outcomes has the library affected and in what ways. This is the number one question I get, which is, all right, the accreditation team showing up at my door, they want to know what effect the library has. It's so diffuse. How do I tell them? Well, if we begin to collect information, understand how they're related together, we can show them. But more than these directions, by mapping the field, you see librarianship as a coherent and more important than ever. Rather than being pulled from trend to trend or chasing dot-coms, you see that libraries serve a vital, noble, and extremely relevant function in today's society. You see the importance of trusted spaces, physical and virtual, in furthering communities like cities, colleges, businesses, and governments. You see a powerful agent for positive social change. You see a locus of innovation. When you see the whole field and break through a crust of functions and policies and standards and see librarians stripped down to their intentions, what you see is a noble and vital vocation. You see a future of librarianship honoring its past while inventing its own future. We stand at a point in time of our choosing and our creation, and we must now decide. We must decide between preserving functions and reifying the current or shaping the future. We are the future of libraries. It rests in our hands. I have no doubt that you and I together can ensure that the golden days of librarianship are ahead of us and not behind us. Thank you for your time. I certainly would be very interested in any questions, comments, or clarifications that you might be interested in engaging in. Or I just may put them to sleep.
No, I was about to type in. do you mind if I? Because I had sort of one big question.
Jump in. Who was the librarian at the Philadelphia Public Library? Oh, I can talk. The librarian that I was working with, we were working with a whole group. We were working with the the foundation group with Linda Johnson, who's no longer there, and a few other folks. But we were also talking. I'm gonna blank on this for a moment. Anyway, we're working with all the librarians around there, talking with musicians, mostly classical musicians. It was an interesting conversation because we sort of sat down with a bunch of different groups and they said, you know, popular music's kind of handled. It's happening in the clubs, the big connections, we have ways of getting the music out, we have an industry that can take care of them. World music and classical music and art music, this has no place to go. And in fact, there's no, you know, we don't talk about a threatened business model, it doesn't exist. Imagine if we could create a space where these folks had a place to build community and they could perform, and that performance would become captured by the library, annotated by the library, made back available to their patrons. But what happens over time is if you do this, you begin to become a place where not just where Philadelphians come to learn about music outside of their community, but where outside of the community comes into the library to learn about the Philadelphia sound and the Philadelphia music. So I can get you the actual names, and I'm kicking myself for not having them at my fingertips. But it was a really group effort. Can you recommend a source for an introduction to conversation theory? Actually, a couple sources you can take a look at. If you go to a site, I'll type this in so you can copy and paste. If you go to the participatory test bed that we're putting together, ptbed.org, you'll see reading lists that give you introductions to some of these concepts. You'll see lots of articles that take it deeper. If you really want to look at conversation theory itself as a theory, because it was not created in the context of libraries, Wikipedia is not a bad place to get an overview, but then you'll find citations there to the original volumes that PASC put together, follow-ups by people like Pangaro and such. So take a look at that website. You'll find an abstract, a bibliography, and readings. These ideas seem so elemental, yet they are elusive. Where is the disconnect? Oh, I'll let go so you can give, so we can talk.
No, David and I are in the same room, so I just wanted, if you wanted to keep talking about it, that was fine. But I listening to the conversation, you know, your talk, and I felt like, you know, when I heard you say we're moving from quiet buildings with a few noisy rooms to noisy buildings with a few quiet rooms, and the idea of sort of the transformation into information commons, and it seems like various organizations, institutions are sort of in the wide spectrum of that, either moving toward it or trying to move toward it, you know, with budgets and all that. And so I guess I just, you know, my question is, it seems so, it seems so at the crux of what librarians do, and yet we're sort of talking about it, and you know, David's getting, you know, was getting...
Animated,
even, you know, even just in a room with the two of us, and I guess I just kind of wonder, like, why doesn't it seem like it's just sort of a natural extension, or it manifests itself in a natural extension versus something that, you know, I hear about being talked about for, you know, a long time and feeling like there's some sort of disconnect, and maybe I'm wrong about that.
Bob Wedgeworth, former president of ALA, shared with me one of his favorite quotes, which was, don't rally the troops until you're willing to give them marching orders. And I think we've done a lot of rallying the troops, and I include myself very much in being guilty of this, where we can preach and we can talk about it, but it's time to get serious in how we do it. And, you know, part of the work that we're doing, the Philadelphia Free Library came out of sort of re-envisioning what their central library would look like through this conversational lens. Some of the ones I didn't talk about, for example, was building an entrepreneurium, which looks more like FedEx Kinko's or whatever they're calling it these days, rather than a reading room full of stacks, because people need to come in and they want to start businesses and they do field trips out and they have daycare, for example, this was the plan. Budgets, you know, we all know that story. But we've been working on trying to provide some real examples. I know Eli presented before me, and looking at some of the work that he's done in online cataloging, we can see examples of this percolating to the top. What we need to do is figure out why they make sense. What I keep missing is, well, all right, it's always enjoyable to give outrageous statements. So here's my outrageous statement for the moment. I don't think we should have next generation cataloging conversations. I think we should have last generation cataloging conversations. I think we should scrap it and start again. catalogs are built as inventory systems to find things we know exist. They're not very good for discovery systems. And the main problem is if you're going to build a quote-unquote social catalog, how social are your books now? Do they sit on the stacks late at night talking to each other and inviting yourself over for dinner? No, because that doesn't make any sense. They're things. They're artifacts. We need to build people-centered systems that connect and find it. But once again, this is me preaching out loud. I think what we need to do is build a significant critical mass of people to say, stop it. And then we need to pull out the good examples. So pull out the tagging examples that Eli does in the gaming programs, the gaming stuff that Jenny Levine and Scott Nicholson are working on. Look at the kinds of programs that are being put in place in public libraries like Charlotte, Mecklenburg County, and Cuyahoga County Library in Ohio, and highlight that, but then say, look, these aren't exceptions. These are the rule, and it's what we should be working for. And what my big effort in this as the academic is to say, but you know what, these aren't, the reason they work is it makes sense that they work. I mean, how many people start feeling like Second Life is going to become the tube tops and miniskirts of library generation, where it's like, oh, it was trendy and cool, we tried it, and why didn't anyone show up? Well, why'd you try it? I'm all for experimentation and trying new things, but we need a big framework to plug in and say, oh, this is why it would work, or this is when it would work, or this is how it would work. And I'll, once again, take plenty of responsibility that even when we prepare librarians, we're so busy teaching them skills, we forget to teach them the religion that the skills came from. Will we be cataloging in 10 years? I actually don't know, and I would like to have that question and conversation rather than just assuming that the way you define a librarian is by cataloging. Because if you don't catalog, therefore you're not a librarian? Or is it the fact that we do cataloging to achieve some function? All right, now I'm rambling. I'll shut up if there are other questions.
My takeaway from this, and I'm not a practicing librarian at the time, but my takeaway from this is that you have to be willing to have somewhat of a critical eye even to things that you absolutely love to do, and as well, just keep conversations happening, because that's really the only way you do sort of meander, and I use meander sort of maybe there's a better word for that, but I do feel like you can't go forward if you're not willing to meander a little bit. But I think that, your example about Second Life, I think that question is being asked quite a bit. And yet, at the same time, there are some really great projects and programs and appropriate things that seem to be kind of shaking out. And so, I think in any field, it seems like we all sort of need to be able to step back and be somewhat critical, and at the same time have the conversations. This has been incredibly wonderful. I hope that everybody's enjoyed, and I certainly don't want to cut the conversation short.
I want that one. Hold on.
Okay, yep, go for it.
The advantage of being in the same room. I'm a father of a brilliant and wonderful 9-year-old, a brilliant and wonderful 6-year-old. And one of the things that I have learned in watching them grow, that I've always believed in but seen really specifically, is the power of play. And I think that your meandering, your experimentation and playing and trying new things and going into Second Life, let me be real clear. I don't want you to walk away going, David thinks that we should only do strategic things and stop messing around. Quite the opposite. And if you knew me and saw what I do, I play a lot. Right? But the thing about play is when a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old play, they do it to learn. What they're learning is how to entertain, how to socialize, how things come together when they're building puzzles and they're learning cause and effect. And in essence, play is a very constructive and powerful process. And what we have to figure out as librarians, I think we should do, by the way, much more playing. I think we should become much more risk averse so that we can play. But what we're not so good at, and frankly, I wouldn't even say librarians, I would say, organizations in general, are knowing when the play stops and how to absorb the lessons of the play into the organization, right? We've all seen circumstances where the brilliant new group starts something, right? It's like I remember in the days of the first websites, this guy coming up to me, he was in education, but he's like, I built the perfect website. I said, really? He goes, oh, yeah. Oh, I'd spent nights on it and everything, and it was perfect. It was beautiful. It was just the way it was organized. It was great. And then they found it. And I said, they? Who's them? He goes, the administration. They found it, and suddenly they wanted to change things and look at the wording and then change by committee, and they ruined the website. Well, here's the trick. If you don't think strategically and can't make an argument for how your perfect website or what you've been playing with and discovering and learning, at some point, if you can't turn that into, and this is how it fits our strategic mission, this is how it fits our clientele and our needs, this is how it fits together, then what you end up with is people messing up your perfect stuff. But you might, you know, it also helps you answer the question. So I'm a big Eli Neiberger fan. And he had a great comment code, and it was, and I'm going to get it wrong, but it's something to the effect of, you need more prostitutes and pie. Right? There was a comment card for how could the Ann Arbor Library be better? More prostitutes and pie. If you want to increase your usage population, pornography and pizza will work just fine. But the question is that really in our mission? You know, or are we just, you know, some people will have fun with that. Some people like pizza. But the idea is, how does it fit into this larger global mission? Well, just like you say, oh, well, that's so obvious it doesn't fit in. You know, well, if you're in Las Vegas, maybe not so obvious. But, well, where does Second Life or Facebook or the comfy couch or the children's reading group? Here's one. I'm having a good conversation with librarians in Houston talking about children's reading hours. When do you offer story time? And almost all the libraries said, well, you offer between, you know, not 10 and 1. And they said, you realize by doing that, you're offering an elite service, because what stay-at-home parent exists that can come to the library? How many double incomes do we have where really they need story time from 6 to 7 at night? So looking at this and saying, just because we have a good idea or we always used to do it that way, our mission is to engage people in conversations, and if the conversations have to have at night, let's do it. So I want you to play, and I want you to go nuts playing, and I want every new gadget and whiz-bang and buy the Kindles, and I do, and learn about them. But at some point, you have to have, and even a process, after 1 month, after 1 year, after 1 day, I don't care, a process that says stop, think, do we need it? And the only way you can answer the do we need it, do we want it, or how we modify it for our own purposes is to understand very clearly your mission, and your mission is not stuff and things and books and buildings. It's people and learning and knowledge. I will now shut up. I apologize.
No apology necessary. I hope that not just those who are in our session, but those who maybe weren't able to participate in these conversations here at ALA will be able to take a look at this recording and, you know, really get inspired and, you know, just think and, you know, take a step back and be excited. So you know, if there are no other questions, and David, do you have anything else you want to add? All right. Well, we're going to close out this session. We've got one more. I'm going to turn off my mic and let David just wrap things up. But I want to thank David Lincoln and all of our audience for a great session.
Thank you all very much. I get to go face the traffic and head to an airport, so I appreciate it very much. Talk to you all later. Please, by the way, my website's there. Find my email. If I know sometimes it takes a while to digest and realize exactly how stupid I just said something, but, you know, if you really get in there and there's something bothering you, let me know. Let's keep the conversation going. Thanks a lot. Hope you don't.